What's up, Internet, and welcome back to the Engadget Podcast. I'm Senior Editor Devendra Hardwar. This week, I'm joined with Deputy Editor Nathan Ingram. Hey, Nate.
Hey, Dev. How's it going?
It's going okay. And we also have Ben Elman, Podcast Producer here, who'll be chiming in later. Hey, Ben.
Hello.
Hello. And we'll have a special guest on in a bit. Paris Marks, the noted tech critic. He has a great newsletter, is going to be joining us to talk about, I think, a pretty wild story. But before that, Nate is also going to be talking about the new Spider-Man 2 game on PlayStation 5. And we've got a bunch of other news. As always, folks, if you're enjoying the show, please subscribe to us on iTunes or your podcatcher of choice. I really like Pocket Cast, so give that a shot. Leave us a review on iTunes. Drop us an email at podcast@engadget.com. And yeah, folks, we are still kind of paused when it comes to our live streams, but I'm looking at ways to bring that back. So let us know. Let us know if you're still into that. podcast@engadget.com. So, Nate, I brought you here today because you reviewed Spider-Man 2, the latest big-budget release on the PlayStation 5, and we've talked before about these massive Sony games. I feel like you're just on the hook for them all the time, right? Like, you are in the bag for the big Sony games.
I am in the bag, I have to admit it. I like Spider-Man, but he's not, like, a favorite superhero of mine, but I played the 2018 game like a year after it came out or so, and I was just like enthralled with it because they got web swinging around the city so perfectly. Like one of my favorite, one of my favorite mechanics in all video games that I played in the last 10 years. You can build a game, around that mechanic and how well they render New York City, and it's just like a playground of fun as far as I'm concerned. And of course, as usual with the big Sony sequels, I think of like Horizon Forbidden West, God of War Ragnarok. This one follows in the same tradition of being bigger. Everything is bigger. The stakes are higher. But in this particular case, it doesn't reach the point of bloat, which is what makes it work so well.
Uh-huh. Because I feel like that the first game kind of suffered from that. Like, I did love the mechanics of it. I love the characters. And that game also introduced Miles Morales like later on. Like, it had a good storyline. It was really good, except I am so tired of open world games where it's just like all you get is a big map and on every corner of the map are these little things to collect or little, you know, activities to accomplish. I'm just like, I wish it was more focused. And we ended up getting that game with the Miles Morales game, which basically launched with the PlayStation 5. I thought that game was perfect. I loved that thing. How, like, where does this weigh in compared to the first Spider-Man or the Miles Morales game to
you? Yeah, good question. The world is bigger. Right. You can go to Brooklyn and Queens. They aren't fully rendered like Manhattan is, but you get large chunks of those boroughs, which is.
Oh, I'd love to see which chunks they get. Yeah.
Yeah. You can see a lot in Brooklyn for sure. And it's cool because obviously the like layout of those parts of the city is so different than Manhattan. There's less skyscrapers. So the web wings come in handy there, which is a new feature where you can like glide around the city versus swinging. And once you get the hang of that, jumping between those two mechanics is a super fun way for traversal. I think there are less of the little fetch side quests. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. There's like a handful of like, there's maybe three like side quests that are pretty like big story-driven stuff that augment the game. Those are great. And then there's some collectibles, but it's not as intense as like finding 100 backpacks and taking 100 photos. Like there's still things like that, but it's not as overwhelming. And then there's a few other side ones, but I felt in general they did a better job of being more judicious about that sort of activity. When I finished the main meat of the game, when I finished the story, and some of the side quests, and obviously picking up at these little goals as I went, I had about 65 to 70% of the game done, it said. So, you know, even without trying super hard to, like, go collecty-collecty, I did a good job of getting, like, most of the key stuff.
That's cool. And I know you can play as both Peter Parker and Miles Morales in this game. Like, how does that balance work for you? I'm sure, like, certain story missions, you have to be one character. But how does the game balance, you know, having two Spider-Men?
Good question also, because they have very, like, the core move set is the same, but there's a lot of new special moves you get that differentiate their two styles, and you can, you know, obviously upgrade those or swap in ones that you like better than others, which is cool. And yeah, there's some particular story missions where the story itself moves you between the two characters. We saw that in the demo that they showed maybe in June. They showed a good like 10, 15 minutes of gameplay where you're on the river like chasing down Kraven and the Lizard. And that's a wild set piece. And yeah, you're doing something as Peter, and then it says, oh, like, he's going to go do X, now Miles, you do Y, and it switches seamlessly over to Miles, now you're controlling Miles, and it jumps back and forth between those points of view.
That is flashback to, like, 10 years ago with Grand Theft Auto 5, which is, I think, that was kind of a big thing in that game, and Rockstar was trying to have, like, this sort of, like, split action across different locations, yeah.
That's interesting. I didn't play that, but I believe you. It works pretty well here. It doesn't happen in a ton of missions. There's maybe, like, I want to say half a dozen at most, where there's, like, the really big moments in the game where, like, everything's happening and you're going between them. The rest of the time, there'll be, like, sections of a mission where you're Peter and you do X, Y, and Z, and then you finish that section and then it swaps back over to Miles. But when you're in the open world, you can switch between the two of them seamlessly. If you're like, oh, I want to like just use someone else. There's a handful of those side missions that are specific to each character. So if you try to start one of those, like you need to switch to Peter or Miles. But yeah, I think it's really well done. It's good to have the two different character perspectives. The story does both of them justice. I think overall, you play as Peter slightly more in the main story, but like Miles gets some of the wildest moments in the game. Mm-hmm. So yeah, I feel like both characters got their due for sure.
That's cool. That's cool. It's good to hear. From the clips I've seen, I also see they both call each other Spider-Man, which I think is hilarious. Like, it's a very much like the Batman cartoon series. Like, hey, Spider-Man, what's going on? Like, Spider-Man, please. They're just pointing at each other, basically.
It is, and I thought about that at first. I was like, oh, I know why they're doing it, because they don't want to reveal their identities. They can't say so-and-so when they're out in public anyway, right? So, but it is funny, because, you know, the closed captions, it'll say Spider-Man, there's a little icon for Peter, and a slightly different one for Miles, so you can differentiate them.
That's cool. Well, I mean, I'm glad this ended up well for Sony. I feel like I didn't think that they couldn't accomplish this. This is a pretty, we are what, 3 years into the PlayStation 5 at this point, and it took this long for like, you know, a full-on sequel to Spider-Man. We did get the remastered version of the first game. Did you ever play that on PS5?
I haven't. I'm going to go back and try it though at this point, just because I had so much fun with part two that I want to mess around with the original a little bit.
Yeah, I'm intrigued by that, because that gets up to 60 FPS. And that's like the thing. I never finished the first game. Like, I put a lot of time into that.
But
it's sort of like, by the time, like, it feels like the PS5 started coming pretty quickly, like soon after that. And I was like, okay, playing a game, especially a console game in 30 FPS, really, I will only do it if there is no other option, right? So now I have to go basically go buy the remastered version of that first game. You can get it as a combo pack with Miles Morales too, so that's something.
The new one goes up to 120 if your TV supports it.
That's cool. I think
Miles does too, I believe.
I forget like what the exact setting there is.
For
a game like this, like, I don't think you really need 120. It's more like that's always great for like shooters and super fast paced games.
Yeah.
But I would rather have the balance of like 1440p with 60 FPS and maybe some of the fun ray tracing stuff.
It looks fabulous. The character models are pretty great, especially the big villains. Like the lizard looks wild. Like the detail on this like lizard skin and teeth and stuff is great. Spoiler also, I think everyone knows this from the trailers and so forth, but Venom is in the game. Venom also looks terrifying.
I mean, the black suit is on the cover of the game, right? Or it's
right.
Everywhere,
yeah. So. I mean, all the previews have shown you play as Peter with the black suit. And if you know anything about Spider-Man, you know where this is going. And it goes, and it's awesome. It's really well done.
That's cool. Glad to hear it's good, Nate. Like, where does this rank among, you know, you've played all the major like PlayStation 5 exclusives at this point and all the big budget ones. Like, where does this rank among Sony releases for you at this point?
I think it's up there because, like I said, the story is lengthy without feeling overlong. The side stuff, it's very easy to like be moving around the city and jump into a new activity and then jump out of it and get back to where you're going, which I love. And I think like character-wise, like I said, like I'm not a huge Spider-Man guy, but I do find him to be a fun character most of the time.
I mean, so, it's a good time for Spider-Man.
It's fun. It's a fun game. And I was going to say that in the last like 6 months, I've had a hard time finding a new game to latch onto. I played a lot of Tears of the Kingdom for our review of it. And when I was done with the review, I didn't go back to it much because it just felt like too much. And Spider-Man does not feel like too much. It feels like just the right amount. And it just sucked me right in, and I had no problem like banging out the main story in the like 2-ish weeks that I had. Obviously, I was playing a lot during that time, but like I never was like, oh, I have to go back and play this again. I was always like down for whatever. Like this story has great momentum. The gameplay has great momentum. It's just fun to play. It's pure fun.
Tears of the Kingdom feels like, I know I'm going to play this game forever, right? So I'm not like in a rush to complete it, whereas Spider-Man feels like there's a cohesive story. I do like this trend of slightly more, a smaller and more self-contained open world games. Like I'm also playing Assassin's Creed, the new one was Mirage. And it's, it's very much classic Assassin's Creed. There's no more XP meter, right? There's no more leveling up. You gain new tools and new abilities through just finishing quests. But I really like the fact that it's just so small. Like, it's not overwhelming with stuff. I follow the story. There are a couple side missions I can do. But it doesn't feel like a game that I'm going to be forced to play for, like, 100 hours or so to see everything. Whereas the last few Assassin's Creeds have just, like, they felt like too much. You know, I really loved Origins. Odyssey was okay. And then Valhalla was just like, I don't need as much of this.
I would say that Spider-Man 2 is the perfect opposite side of the Valhalla experience, where instead of they could have gone that direction, right, and just like thrown everything in there, but they didn't. They crafted a tight story, tight gameplay. Like the skill trees aren't like totally bonkers, and you can like engage with that stuff as much or as little as you want to, I think. Like if you want to like really tweak out your moves and switch them in and out and like upgrade every single gadget, you can do that. Otherwise, like most of the time I would like every like handful of level ups I got, I'd be like, oh, I should take stock and like upgrade a few things. But it wasn't like I didn't like lose sleep trying to figure out how to like maximize my Spider-Man.
All right. Well, I'm glad you enjoyed the game. Check out Nate's full review at Engadget.com. Thanks so much, Nate. Next up in news, we want to talk about Mark Andreessen, who apparently had some free time lately, enough time to write up something called the Techno-Optimist Manifesto, which is his sort of declaration about what he believes about the world, about how tech is kind of the one solution for our future. I found it kind of hilarious and kind of scary, but I wanted to bring in, you know, somebody who can also help us break this down. Paris Marks is a podcaster at Tech Won't Save Us. He writes the newsletter Disconnect, and he's a tech critic. Hello, Paris.
Hello. Great to speak with you.
Yeah, I've been looking forward to chatting with you for a while, actually, and this seems like the perfect opportunity because I can only describe this thing as batshit insane. And also joining us in this discussion is podcast producer Ben Ellman. Hey, Ben.
I find this fascinating. Let's talk about it.
So we're just going to dive right in here.
Let's just dive right in.
Is our starting point.
Let's say the starting point is listeners. First of all, go write, look up the Techno-Optimist Manifesto. You will see kind of like the basics of what this is.
Or don't.
But that is what we're referring to. It's this very long document where Mark Andreessen is known for just writing very long blog posts about his view of the future, right? He wrote something about AI, why AI is very important and will save us all several months ago. This whole manifesto is his vision of the tech world, it seems, and also something that seems like the worldview of the Effective Acceleration crew that he is a part of. So those people who have E/ACC in their Twitter bios, they're usually tech people. They're usually the people who are all in on crypto and AI and tech solutionism and things like that. Those folks, I especially like billionaires, especially VCs, I feel like they're kind of aggrieved right now. I feel like all the criticism coming from media and other folks and people like Paris too is really getting on their nerves. So I don't know. I just imagine Mark Andreessen somewhere on like one of those tropical islands he owns. He must own one or two or something. And just like
perhaps
having
in
a
an
lot
ivory tower,
perhaps in an ivory tower on an ivory colored beach or something, but having a lot of time to sit down and write this thing, which covers things like his view of lies, the lies media is telling about technology, the techno capital machine, his belief that like capitalism and technology is will save us all, and his enemies, which is just a downright terrifying. Like, it gets to some scary stuff by the end. Paris, what's your first takeaway having read this thing?
I think my main takeaway having read it is that it's like, obviously these people in Silicon Valley are not often not your religious types, right? Like you obviously have the Peter Thiels who, you know, are openly kind of religious and you know, kind of faithful people, I guess. But often I think you would find in Silicon Valley a lot of people who would say that, you know, they aren't very religious. But I think that when you look at this document, you see this real kind of secular religion of technology, right? It's very much faith-based when you
believe is a key word. Like exactly. Almost every statement believes with believe, yeah.
Yeah, absolutely. The whole thing is through belief. And if you look at the types of things he's saying he believes, these are not often kind of empirical facts. These are kind of, you know, things that he feels really strongly are the case in society or how the world works or whatever. And, you know, it's very well reflected in this manifesto and in this kind of larger belief system that he's putting out there. So I think that that's a key part of it. I think what you're saying about kind of how these tech billionaires are aggrieved, how they are feeling, you know, the fact that people are criticizing tech more and more is part of that. You know, that has been there for a little while. You talked about his AI manifesto. You can also go back to 2020 when he wrote that one, It's Time to Build, when he was really kind of championing the tech industry. But I think that there's another piece of this as well, where he's also trying to, you know, there's been talk in recent years of regulating the tech industry as well. You know, the tech industry is also kind of in this kind of challenging or difficult moment as interest rates have risen, and that has kind of messed up the whole business model that was based on low interest rates and cheap money. And so I think that plays into that as well. You don't see him talking about crypto, but he is talking about how AI is essential for this future he's talking about, but also how we need to like embrace and champion the tech industry. And I think that plays really well for someone like him, who is obviously a venture capitalist and makes his money off of unregulated tech and kind of having these things proliferate everywhere.
Absolutely. And one thing I want to quickly mention, like, who is Marc Andreessen, right? Like, he was the developer of Netscape Navigator. And the younger folks on this, you know, listening to this podcast may not realize this, but once upon a time, you had to pay for a web browser. And I remember exactly when Netscape came out. I used to use Mosaic. I used to use the AOL web browser. And I think Netscape was like $30 or something. It was a while until, like, I think it was bought. Did AOL buy it at that point and then just made it free or something? But that was where he got his start. And everybody thought he was a genius. And then he started Andreessen Horowitz and started just investing like crazy. So that's who this guy is. You've probably seen pictures of him. You've definitely seen Andreessen Horowitz, the name. But he is somebody who's been in the tech world from a very young age, basically. Ben, go ahead.
Yeah, so Paris, I wanted to ask a couple of table-setting questions before we got into this actual manifesto. And you mentioned the stuff that I wanted to talk about, so I'm going to try to compress these questions into one. So Andreessen Horowitz like bet big on crypto and Web3 a couple years ago. That didn't pan out. You also mentioned like the high inflation, high interest rate environment that we have right now. I keep on thinking that all of this focus on artificial intelligence is to have a new shiny object to keep retail investors, VCs, throwing more money into the pile so they're still excited about something. How much of that is true and how much of that am I just making up?
Yeah, that's my view as well. Like you basically see the crypto bubble. You know, I don't think we can really talk about the metaverse having ever really driven a lot of investment, though they were certainly
nothing.
Hoping. Exactly.
Yeah.
They were hoping that was going to be another big thing, right? And it didn't really work out. But crypto was kind of the big one through the pandemic. You started to see that bubble collapse or, you know, start to deflate around November of 2021. And then through 2022, we started to see a lot of kind of the crypto collapses and bankruptcies and things like that, with FTX kind of being like, you know, the cherry on that cake, November of last year, I believe that was. And so that was really what was happening to the crypto industry. And through that time, you were also seeing, you know, Western governments raising interest rates significantly for the first time in basically 15 years, right? And we know that the tech industry kind of based their business model on easy access to capital, low interest rates, so that, you know, this capital could not easily find good returns just in the general market. So they went into more risky endeavors, and that benefited the tech industry, because certainly you're going to have a lot of startups that, you know, fail, that don't make anything, but you're going to have some that really become massively huge, right? And so they were willing to take those risks on these companies that didn't have clearer business models, and that benefited the tech industry. And so then as these interest rates rise, that, you know, the idea that capital is going to flood into the tech industry in the same way is not there. And so magically ChatGPT comes along as this magic thing to kind of give the whole industry a boost, keep investment flowing into not just OpenAI and Microsoft and Google and whatnot, but these new startups that are trying to enter this kind of AI landscape. And you also have, on top of the investment piece of it, like it gives the tech industry another kind of hype moment to say, look, like, you know, we're changing the world again and blah, blah, blah. And I think like many of these cycles we're going to see, and I think we're already starting to see kind of the energy kind of come out of that cycle. And I think we're going to see that like ChatGPT and stuff doesn't really end up being the whole big transformative thing that the companies have been suggesting.
I mean, also part of this too is like, you know, it's not just crypto, but it's also the pandemic as well. And a lot of companies were investing in ways because people were buying more PCs and people were staying at home more to watch Netflix, and they were overinvesting in employees and things. Well, that's why we're seeing a ton of layoffs and things now. And we'll talk about this later. Netflix bumping up its prices again. The companies are kind of reacting to the fact that I think at least the way tech usage has been going is normalizing a bit, because we were over-reliant on it when a lot of folks were stuck at home too. So the changing landscape, right, between money not being essentially free with low interest rates and all this stuff. So, yeah.
Yeah, let's talk about risk then, because this manifesto is all about risk. It's all about going faster and faster and faster. And if you even want to ask us to think to slow down, you are the problem.
Absolutely. I think that like this stuff kind of looks new now, but I think you can go back to the 2020 It's Time to Build manifesto and see a lot of these ideas already in there, right? And that manifesto was released just a couple months into the pandemic. And basically the idea was the tech industry is going to save us from the pandemic and all this economic slowdown and stuff like that that we're experiencing in this moment, right? But kind of the core of that was to say, listen, the tech industry is delivering, you know, for the public, you know, is making the world a better place. And the tech industry has been kind of not pushing itself like it has been in the past. And that's actually bad for the world. And we need to kind of use our power and kind of seize a greater degree of power within society to continue transforming along the lines of kind of what the tech industry wants to see. And so I think that, you know, in this manifesto, you can see the kernels, you can see how that was like the kernel of what this has kind of become. And, you know, as Devendra was saying, like, there are these like series of ideologies that the tech industry has been adopting of late. You know, maybe listeners have heard of Tescreel, which is basically just this kind of group of ideologies, you know, everything from transhumanism and long-termism and rationalism and all this kind of stuff that has been associated with the tech industry. The term was previously in Mark Andreessen's bio on Twitter. He's removed it now and replaced it with E/ACC, effective accelerationism. And that's basically, you know, people have probably heard of effective altruism. You know, Sam Bankman-Fried was really big into that stuff, this idea that, you know, these people need to make a lot of money so they can funnel it into like effective philanthropy. This is basically saying, let's cut out the philanthropy part of this. We just need to like push technology, adopt technology as much as possible. And again, for someone like Andreessen, I think you can very clearly see how it benefits him, right? He's saying AI is a key part of this future, so don't regulate AI because we want these companies to continue growing. But he's also saying in general, don't regulate the tech industry. Don't try to rein us in, because we are going to be essential to whatever better future is on offer. And I think that kind of the scary part here is that it's not just about, you know, kind of the religious things that I was talking about, this kind of faith in technology. But I think that there are some really kind of scary and kind of fascist adjacent ideas that are increasingly being communicated in these types of manifestos and what the tech industry is doing, right?
Indeed. I mean, one thing I just want to mention real quick is like this, reading this made me maybe think of the Futurism Manifesto by Marinetti, which
and he cites Marinetti at the end.
He cites Marinetti. He does cite it like as one of the patrons of this whole idea. But like that whole thing.
Actually, the crazier thing there is that in the manifesto, he says, to paraphrase a manifesto from a different time, beauty only exists in struggle, so on and so on. He does not explicitly mention Filippo Marinetti anywhere except for the patron saints section at the very bottom.
I don't think Ada Lovelace agreed to be a patron saint this whole thing.
No, I'm seeing all these names here. It's like he just decided to draft these people into service here and say that they support his nonsense.
Yeah, I have a lot to say about that too, but like we'll save that for a little later. But he never mentions this person by name because, yes, Filippo Marinetti wrote the Futurist Manifesto, and then 10 years later, the Fascist Manifesto, along with Mussolini and...
Yeah, so if you've heard the term futurism in art, in literature, in anything from like the early 20th century, a lot of proto-fascist ideas kind of going on there. And that was split up into all sorts of things. But fascism seems like very much linked to this idea of, relentless progress. Nate, I feel like you want to say something. Yeah,
I was going to say that Paris, when you were mentioning this like growth at all costs thing, there was a couple sections that I took note of. One of which is, we believe any deceleration of AI will cost lives. Deaths that were preventable by the AI that was prevented from existing is a form of murder. And okay, so that's a bold statement about grow or die. And then similarly, there's something about we believe there's no inherent conflict between the techno-capital machine and the natural environment. So just saying like, let's not worry about this stuff. It's all going to be fine, right?
Because he believes it.
Not right, because he believes it. That's the thing. Yeah. My thing with this document is that there's no actionable steps here to achieve these goals. It's like, I think that I can make a ship that'll take me alone to the moon by next summer.
I was reminded
great
of
show me.
There is a quote from The Simpsons I think about a lot, and that is Kodos, one of the aliens playing as Bill Clinton. And when he has that speech, my fellow Americans, as a young boy, I dreamed of being a baseball. But tonight I say, we must move forward, not backward, upward, not forward, always twirling towards freedom. I kind of got those vibes reading this. I want to really like read a specific quote from this manifesto too. Like one of the things he says is, we believe that we are, have been, and will always be masters of technology, not mastered by technology. Victim mentality is a curse in every domain of life, including in our relationship with technology, both unnecessary and self-defeating. We are not victims. We are conquerors.
It's a lot of it.
I don't know what any of this is.
One of the things that I keep tripping up on too is, what does he even mean by technology? It's such a broad term that it loses all sense of meaning here.
Well, it seems like any human-made tool. And the thing is, like, what is wild to me about this is because I was not only getting Marinetti vibes, I was getting very much Ted Kaczynski vibes reading this too, which I remember reading.
But the mirror image of Kaczynski, right?
It's basically the mirror image because, you know, Kaczynski had the opposite, the Unabomber, who, you know, killed several people and was mailing bombs and hand delivering bombs to people. It's an awful thing. But his manifesto has been out there. He forced it to get published in major newspapers. It was something I ended up studying in the 90s when I was in high school. And his whole thing is against technology, right? Against the Industrial Revolution and the industrial era. But his view of the world, the sort of like aggrievedness he feels against, specifically like when it comes to like, I don't know, even things like diversity and gender equality, like they both have issues with any of these ideas, right? Any of those are a distraction from their ultimate goal. Kaczynski's goal was to stop progress, basically. And Andreessen's is progress at all costs. But it is kind of weird how the language and the overall vibe between the two feels very similar.
When you say progress at all costs, I go back to another section here, which is that we believe material abundance ultimately means more people, which leads to more abundance. He says that we believe the global population can quite easily expand to 50 billion people. Again, I'd love to know how that's going to work, you know, when we clearly have limited resource. Like, it's like, to deny that is just a ridiculous thought at this point. I know he talks about leaving Earth and going to the stars. Like, okay, great, sure. Once again,
tell me 50 billion humans in, you know, in the solar system or something, but not on the planet. I don't know what you're talking about. Yeah.
But he also talks about how kind of technology is going to allow us to kind of, evade those limits, right? Because technology makes everything more efficient and more productive and like blah, 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 right? I think that like the other thing I was thinking as I was reading this was, you know, if you go back to like the 70s, right? You really do have this melding of like the ideology of the tech industry and this idea that like technology in itself is going to make everything better. And also these like neoliberal ideas that are emerging at the time, right? That the government is not good for anything, that we need to rely on the market. And like you very much see the fusing of these ideas within Silicon Valley. You know, people like Steve Jobs are like the prophets of these kinds of ideas, right? You know, people think back to like Ronald Reagan and they're like, oh, you know, he hated the government. He was all, kind of private market. He was also really big on the tech industry and like,
I mean, he was a Californian, you know, like totally. That's where the founders of Wired, including people like Kevin Kelly, who's still out there writing stuff, and he's traveling the world taking photos now. Like, I have read a lot of his coverage, but it is hard to, it's clear, like, the worldview of those folks has kind of led to a lot of the foundational, it's been the foundational philosophies for, like, this entire industry in a way, too.
Yeah, absolutely. It's fascinating, though, to think that, like, okay, these ideas are there. They kind of make their way through the next few decades, really shape a lot of what the tech industry does. But I think that in this moment, like one of the maybe inconsistencies, I think, with Andreessen's manifesto is that in this moment, actually, the tech industry is, you know, and it's always had close ties to the government, even when they've denied it. But in this moment in particular, it's fusing much closer bonds with the U.S. government and with the U.S. military, especially as the U.S. and Silicon Valley itself kind of ramp up their kind of Cold War mentality or whatever with China, right? This idea that Chinese technology is a threat to U.S. technology, and as a result, U.S. kind of geopolitical dominance is really kind of bringing these two together. And we see the tech industry as well kind of being much more open about its interest in participating in kind of military projects and whatnot, right? You know, you think of the recent stuff with Elon Musk and Starlink, but now he's recently launched a kind of military specific version of Starlink that has not received very much coverage. And he is kind of a glorified military contractor between SpaceX and the other things that he's doing. So especially when you think back to like the Italian futurism, Marinetti, things like that, when you brought up these comparisons between Silicon Valley billionaires and futurism in the past, some of the big pushbacks were, yeah, but like they were really into war and Silicon Valley is not really into that. And the other thing was they also had this kind of aesthetic movement as well. And I think Silicon Valley is certainly still lacking that unless we're counting.
There is like the Apple aesthetic, I feel like, has certainly.
That's fair. Yeah.
The Johnny Ive aesthetic, like, polished aluminum. Like, it is a big thing that has infected our life because then Samsung kind of copied a lot of it too, the typefaces and everything. So, yeah, it's not being looked at as like an artistic journey because these people abhor the liberal arts, but they love the things that shape their products. And there's certainly like aesthetics that go around that, right?
You know, it's good that you mentioned the Apple aesthetic as maybe a primary like Silicon Valley aesthetic.
It's very futurist. Yeah.
I was about to make some dumb joke about how like Stable Diffusion, like the very like maximalist art that comes out of Stable Diffusion is maybe part of their aesthetic also, but it's just like a chewed up version, a baby birded version of someone else's art anyway.
Absolutely. Absolutely.
Just like this manifesto is a chewed up baby bird version of the futurism manifesto.
When we talk about aesthetics, it makes me think about just the writing and the sheer ineptitude in this.
He clearly every night he just sat down wherever he was, like wherever on the planet. And it was just like, I have a thought. This is his notes app. These are collections.
Neil Patel at The Verge said, "This is some of the worst sentence level writing I've seen in quite a while," and that stuck with me as I tried to read it because it was just so painful.
I feel like you're giving him too much credit though. Like I don't think he's on nice beaches around the world. I just think he's in his boring mansion out in Atherton.
I mean, he must be like
poor people from living and stuff like that.
Like the Epic guy, just like in a really really boring office with no furniture or something. Yeah. That could be him too. Like that could certainly be him. I want to leave listeners with this one tidbit, which infuriates me to no end, because at one point, he's talking about enemies, and it sounds really, really paranoid, really scary, honestly. But at one point, he says, our enemy is the ivory tower, the know-it-all credentialed expert worldview, indulging in abstract theories, luxury beliefs, social engineering, disconnected from the real world, delusional, unelected, and unaccountable, playing God with everyone's lives, with total insulation from the consequences.
Could you possibly describe Silicon Valley billionaires?
Yeah, are you looking in the mirror right
coming
now?
Coming from inside the house.
I did particularly love how he was calling out the communists and the Luddites, you know? Like, you know, I think the Luddites are experiencing a real revival at the moment.
Real revival, yeah.
Yeah, and it's just wonderful to see how much it's really pissing off and getting to someone like Mark Andreessen.
Yeah, the number of times that communism came up was surprising.
Yeah.
And that's also a lot in Kaczynski's thing, too. He's very much against communism and socialism in his thing. Anyway, this is a wild discussion. I'm glad to have you on to talk about this, Paris. You also have a book coming out, right? What's up? What's up with your book?
Oh, yeah. My book came out last year, actually. It's called Road to Nowhere, What Silicon Valley Gets Wrong About the Future of Transportation. And I would say, one of the reasons I didn't read the manifesto until not long before we talked is that I'm also in the process of releasing a series on Elon Musk over on the podcast, 4-part series, 2 parts are out now, called Elon Musk Unmasked. So, you know, if you're interested, if you're not tired of Elon Musk content, there's that as well.
Yeah, be sure to check out the Tech Won't Save Us podcast. And Paris, where else can people find you online these days?
Oh my, how many social media platforms are there now? I'm probably on most of them. Just look up Paris Marx and you'll find me.
All right. Thank you so much, Paris.
Thank you.
Thanks so much to Paris for joining us, folks. And let's move on to other news. Last week, right after we finished recording, or the day after, Microsoft officially completed its Activision Blizzard acquisition. So that whole thing, that was a 21-month battle for a $68.7 billion deal, the biggest deal ever in the video game industry and one of the biggest ever in the tech industry. That whole thing is done. Oh my God. Like, we've covered a lot of things around that, around different regulatory agencies fighting against it, specifically the CMA in the UK, the EU had its own issues. And after all of that, like, the main takeaway is the deal is happening. Some rights were sold to Ubisoft, right? So that's like, there's like different concessions now. Let me get the specific thing.
They feel super minor though. I mean, this whole saga to me just proved the fact that there's no way to stop giant corporations from doing whatever they want because...
Well, at least we tried, right? So here's the other thing. Microsoft sold its streaming rights for Activision Blizzard games to Ubisoft. And that was a big thing to win over the UK's approval. Okay. Yeah. Yeah. All these things, like there's also a 10-year concession to keep Call of Duty on other platforms like PlayStation and also Nintendo. So that is clearly pointing to like future consoles. But that deal is in there. Without any of this pushback, Nate, like we wouldn't have gotten any of these things, right? Like in the past.
True, but like what is the streaming rights going to Ubisoft mean to a consumer in the end?
It doesn't mean like, yeah, it means Microsoft does not fully own it and they have to relicense it back from Ubisoft is the thing. So, yeah, it doesn't mean much other than Microsoft doesn't have full control over what those titles are in the streaming world. And I think like maybe the cloud streaming part of this was a little overblown. I think we were all more worried about the sheer size of it, what this could do to the overall industry, right?
Yeah. Like it feels like it's just another example of like one company having just a little bit too much power in the industry that it's working in.
Yeah. So
straight, simple.
Some people are calling this like a complete failure of the FTC. And I will say, I remember when the WhatsApp deal went through. I remember when a lot of the major deals went through in the 2010s, and there was like nothing. Like Facebook just bought Instagram for $1 billion, and nobody knew enough to stop them. There was like no regulatory like infrastructure really.
Right. Well,
to
Facebook
push back
wasn't
against it. Yeah,
and Facebook wasn't as big and influential then, so it didn't feel like as big of a deal. But to me, Microsoft already is such a mammoth. I mean, Facebook is now too, obviously, or Meta.
Facebook. I mean, when Facebook spent $1 billion for a company, it was because they just had $1 billion lying around that they could easily spend. So they were still pretty big at that point, just not as big as today. Yeah. So anyway, we will keep tabs on like what all this means. It seems like Activision Blizzard games won't end up on Game Pass until next year, most likely. But that is the thing everyone's waiting for. Like that's the big benefit for Microsoft here, for sure. And yeah, we'll keep tabs on it. We'll definitely want to get Jeff Condit on at some point to see like what this means for the overall video game world. We also saw news that X, aka Twitter, has begun charging new users $1 per year to send tweets. It's the Not a Bot program, which is being trialed in New Zealand and the Philippines. I think this is so freaking useless, but Nate, do you have any thoughts here?
I would say, does this have any chance of expanding more widely?
Absolutely. Yeah.
But my notion is like Twitter's X is terrible now. They have long had a problem attracting more users, like even going back to before Musk, like that was their whole thing. It was like they weren't growing at the same rate as a Facebook or, you know, even like Snapchat at some point. So adding another barrier to entry here seems like a real dumb idea. And a dollar doesn't seem like it's going to be enough to make a significant revenue stream. So I don't know.
It's not about revenue, right? It's a Not a Bot program, because I don't know if you've spent a little time on X lately, Nate, but it's garbage because everything is just spam. Like, yeah. Sometimes I don't tweet my own personal stuff, but I retweet things for other folks and try to like lift up ideas. Everything out there is just like spam replies, weird porn accounts, like replying to you, like just garbage. Really? It's pure garbage.
It's so bad, huh?
Even though Elon Musk said like spam was a big problem and he was going to solve it, he created a bigger spam problem with his stupid new blue check system. So this is kind of a thing to push back against that. They're thinking like, you know, maybe spam bots and spammers will not create accounts if they have to spend a dollar to do that. I've seen a lot of other pushback from people who study spam and, you know, hackers and things like that. Like these folks run thousands of accounts. Like spending a dollar to enable their ability to spy out spam is not a big cost at the end of the day. So a lot of people think this won't amount to anything other than being a very dumb move. And it may spread wider. Who knows? Like Elon Musk doesn't really look at data, even though he says he does. But this is an idea that sounds like it could work, you know, like I think like that's how he runs. That's how he rolls.
It has surface plausibility. Yes.
Surface plausibility.
But under any sort of, you know, scrutiny, it falls apart.
Mm-hmm. Apple also announced a new $79 Apple Pencil with a USB-C charging port. This is not the second generation Apple Pencil. I'm very confused by this. But Nate, I feel like you have some hands-on thoughts on this thing.
I feel like I'm the right guy to break this down for you. With the caveat that it is certainly super weird. But I think the notion of having a cheaper Apple Pencil makes sense for some people. The differentiator that Apple is pointing to is that this new one, it doesn't have pressure sensitivity. And the reason they took that out as a cost saving measure is that they say they see there's like one level of people using an Apple Pencil who are like doing, you know, advanced art, and they really rely on those kind of features and they push this thing. And then he's like, there's a lot of other people who mostly use it for like notes and sketching and like less intensive work. And in which case, so this one, you know, you save, I think, $50 over the Gen 2 one. So it's significantly cheaper. It's goofy in that you have to charge with a USB-C, but it's better than the old Lightning one.
That was really, that was the one that charged at the bottom of like your iPad, basically.
Yeah. Yep. So that one still exists though, because that one does support pressure sensitivity.
So
you have
confused.
One of the, it's very confusing. It feels like it's a stopgap to them getting rid of that other one, which I imagine will happen in another year.
So basically, if you want a cheaper Apple Pencil with pressure sensitivity, you should probably try to find old stock of the, was it the original first gen? Is that what they're calling?
Yeah, they're still selling that one, but it only is compatible with the older iPad. So like it's very confusing. They make it pretty clear on their site, like here is what exactly works with each of these, but I think they probably should have taken this as an opportunity to cut ties with the old one and just introduce this new cheaper
one.
This
is the second generation of the first model of the Apple Pencil, but it is not the second generation Apple Pencil. This is such an Apple move. Like oh my God, this is so dumb. Okay, anyway, $79 Apple Pencil with USB-C. Also in other news, Netflix jacked up its price for the premium plan, for the 4K plan, to $23 a month. Also the grandfathered basic subscribers, I don't believe they're offering that basic plan anymore.
They aren't.
But that grandfathered plan is now up to $12 a month. What do you think about these price hikes, Nate? Because I think it's happening really quickly. Yeah.
I've had it. To be honest, every single streaming service this year of note has raised prices, and I'm glad that Netflix didn't raise the price of the like $15.50 one that sits right in the middle. It's It's, I think, offers two simultaneous streams, but it doesn't have 4K. If you want 4K, you have to spend $8 more a month, which is a lot of money. And, you know, I think about it, I'm like, 4K TVs have been around for a decade. I only got my first 4K TV 3 years ago. But in that time, when I think about the stuff that I can actually watch that's in 4K, Netflix, no. Hulu, no. Disney Plus at least has it. I had it on HBO Max, but now that HBO Max is Max, you have to pay $20 instead of $15 to get 4K. So I no longer
have
4K
there. Wait, so you mean you don't want to pay for the 4K?
No, it's too much money. If I was paying for 4K, it would be an extra like $30 a month across the different subscriptions I use. Like, it's crazy.
It's kind of crazy. It is kind of wild. Yeah.
The fact that, like, you know, I'm a fairly like technology forward guy, and yet I still am watching most of my content at upscale 1080p is kind of weird when I think about it.
Yeah. I mean, it still looks good. Like, your TV will make it look good.
It does. Totally fine. It looks wonderful. I never think about it.
But I mean, at the end of the day, I'm also like, Nate, do you remember when VHS tapes were $100? You remember when we had to spend $5 to $10 renting things individually at Blockbuster or whatever?
See, I still don't mind spending $5 to rent something if I want to watch it. I'd rather do that than have to like figure out which of the 15 streaming services has it.
Yeah, that's fair. Unless it's like an original on those services. Well, anyway,
sure.
Yeah, for what I do, and because I have to like review movies and stuff, I have to like keep all these services alive. But I do think it's annoying. Yeah. Like, at the very least, 4K should be standard right now. 4K should be part of the $15 plan rather than being this weird premium tier. Sure, make people pay for more streams, more simultaneous streams. That makes sense. But yeah, just kind of.
And I think, you know, the overall thing I'm looking at is like we're reaching a saturation point where I think people are really going to be like, I can't afford all of these. Like, it's too much money. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So like the notion of continued growth across all these services to me seems impossible because, again, like I'm, you know, an affluent white guy who likes entertainment. And even I'm like, this is stupid. I can't spend this much money on this. So
yeah.
Like,
you don't want to spend $8 more for the 4K. Shame, right. Shame. I mean, I totally get it.
Well, then when you add in all the gaming subscriptions got more expensive this year,
yeah.
Music services are going up, like, we're getting crushed.
We are getting certainly crushed in some ways. I do want to say, this all came from an earnings report for Netflix, and it actually looks like their really draconian password sharing limitations ended up paying off for the company. Like, paid memberships are up to 247.15 million, a 10% annual increase. So people did end up having to subscribe because they wanted to watch Stranger Things and Netflix stuff. So, hey, that made a difference for them, even though everybody complained. I do think there's a good balance here because at the end of the day, like, if you like these things, pay for it, right? If you don't, if it doesn't matter for you, cancel the subscription. Like, it's that simple. But I also think these companies should offer more. 4K is bare minimum at this point. We also saw news about YouTube starting a new news hub that directs you towards reliable sources. This is a bid to stop, you know, misinformation. And I think this is a smart move. Basically, this is going to be an area where you can find live streams, on-demand videos, podcasts, and shorts that are specifically around authoritative sources. So like known media sources and not just random YouTuber ranting about something. To kind of keep people in a hub and to help them ensure that the information they're getting is coming from a more trusted source than random YouTubers. Any thoughts on this, Nate?
I think it's a good idea. I would like to know a little more about how they're deciding what's trustworthy. I feel like, you know, again, I haven't read their blog post about it.
It's major news organizations.
It sounds like they're working with different organizations to sort of like do some best practices. So that makes me feel good about it, at least. I'd say it's definitely needed. You know, you mentioned just some random guy shouting on YouTube. And I think about they added a podcast to the YouTube Music app a few months ago. And when I go to my like explore section of that app, like there's a podcast tile and it's just like trash. Like, I'm like, these aren't podcasts. These are just random people yelling on YouTube.
That's what it is. There was like a little bit of serendipity I had on YouTube recently. Like, I was just browsing around because I got my big phone. I'm spending more time watching a little more video content on the big phone.
What big phone do you have?
The 15 Pro Max. And it's good. I will talk more about that at some point. But I was just browsing around and YouTube served me this Quest 3 like impressions video from looked like a teenager or 20, like a young girl with no, it had like 40 views. She had maybe 5 followers. I'm like, why did YouTube serve me this thing? Maybe because I've been searching about the Quest 3, or is it like actively trying to lift up unseen, like things with low views so that people get more views. I was like, okay, YouTube, thumbs up, subscribe to that channel. And it's just a girl like having like really good thoughts on this thing, not like professionally made, but interesting. So I do think like YouTube is thinking a little more about how it's directing people around its content. So yeah, let us know what you think, folks, about a special, you know, YouTube news thing. I do get a lot of news from YouTube these days, but it's mainly because I'm watching, you know, network feeds, or, you know, I'm subscribed to things that deliver actual news to me rather than random YouTubers. Also,
that's interesting. I haven't used YouTube for news much myself yet, but
I just don't. I don't watch local TV. Like, I don't watch over the air anymore either. So it's like I get a bunch of stuff from YouTube, and it's usually pretty good. I don't get a lot of garbage these days. We also wanted to quickly mention Amazon is now offering drone deliveries for prescription medications in College Station, Texas, which is an area where they've been testing Prime Air drone deliveries since 2022. Now prescriptions are going to be drone delivered. It looks like the drones will fly between 40 and 120 meters. They land at specific markers at people's homes for deliveries. So I don't know how this works, right? If you want drone deliveries, do you have to like set up basically, a little helicopter pad for the drones? Okay. That seems, I have not heard from people at College Station. That is a really interesting town. That's where Texas A&M is. I've not heard reports about people actually using this and enjoying this. What would you like drone deliveries, Nate? Like, you live in the city. That would never work.
I do. It wouldn't work, but the notion of not having to go to the pharmacy is like kind of enticing, I'll have to admit.
It's kind of nice,
I kind of dig that.
But you can get stuff shipped already, like through normal shipping channels.
I'm too lazy to figure it out, though. It's just a pain. So I continue to just walk over to Rite Aid and pick it up.
Yeah,
it's literally
listen, if there's a mistake, like they can fix it for you. So that's a thing. But anyway, Amazon is testing prescription medication deliveries. I wonder how those things will fare. Like if they get left outside in a hot, you know, Texas summer day, it's probably not good for medicine. That doesn't seem good.
I could see capsules melting.
Mm-hmm. A lot of things melting. Anyway, we'll keep an eye on that. I'm not a big fan of drone deliveries. I think that whole thing is garbage.
Yeah, I don't see that taking off. It's like AI.
It's like
it's like ChatGPT for deliveries.
AI, unfortunately, AI is a thing that's going to happen. It's just like,
okay,
based on all of our testing, it's more like crypto. GPT. It's more like, you know what it is? It is flying cars. It is a thing sounds cool, but if you think about it for a goddamn logistical minute, nothing works. Nothing works about it. So anyway, it's flying cars. Anything flying, don't put more things in the air, please. Let's move on to what we're working on. Anything you want to shout out, Nate?
No, I kind of just got off of, I got off of Spider-Man 2, so that was a big one. I got some other little like end of the year stuff cooking at this point as we're like kind of hurtling towards the end of 2023. We'll have, I think, our usual bevy of those stories coming up in the next month or two.
It's that time of the year. We're also prepping for CES and doing all sorts of stuff. Like, on my end, I'm still working on the Big Screen Beyond VR review, which I am honestly liking more than I thought I would. So I'll talk more about that next week. But it's a really cool little headset, not meant for anybody, right? It is not the Quest 3. It's not the Quest 2. Nobody should buy this thing other than the weirdos who really love the Valve Index. But I will talk more about that. It's just funny. It's like a really cool thing for the VR niche. And let's move on to our pop culture picks. Anything you want
to
shout out?
Way to get me to tune in next week. I'm curious.
I mean, it's one of those things, like, it's very good at what it's doing, but nobody should buy this. That's ultimately it. Any pop culture picks for you this week, Nate?
Yeah, I started watching Lessons in Chemistry on Apple TV. I read the book this summer and thought it was wonderful. And then immediately learned that they were making a series out of it with Brie Larson.
Who doesn't love Brie Larson? Yeah.
No, she's wonderful. She's wonderful in the episodes I've watched so far. I think so far the show has looked pretty faithful to the book. I'm sure there'll be some changes to make it work in the medium. But I will shout out both the book, which I devoured it in basically like 2 days. I'm looking up the author right now. Bonnie Garmus is the name of the person who wrote the book, and it's a great read, and the show has been great so far too.
Awesome. I want to shout out The Fall of the House of Usher, which is on Netflix right now. I feel like every year we talk about Mike Flanagan's next series at Netflix, and Sherlyn and I have loved it. Like, we love horror, and we've loved all of his stuff. So this is the guy who did The Haunting of Hill House, The Haunting of Bly Manor, and what's the other one? There's one about an island. The name is escaping me right now. But anyway, I love this guy. I think this guy is fantastic. I've loved all of his horror films. He also did Doctor Sleep. If you watch that, be sure to watch the director's cut, which is a better movie. This is a series set in modern times that is semi-adapting a variety of stories from Edgar Allan Poe. So The House of Usher is one of his stories. but the Raven is here, you know, the Telltale Heart is here, but setting as the backdrop of a very rich family in New York who is somewhat cursed. And I will say, I'd recommend this thing if you watch Succession and you really want those people to die horrible deaths. You know, if you want those people to be punished, it's very much
how that. Horror is this?
It is full on horror. Like, there are scary things. It's gruesome at times. There are jump scares, but it's also like really well acted. Like, I love Mike Flanagan because he is such a good writer. He writes really compelling characters and he always casts some really, really, like, he has a troupe of people he tends to work with, like Rahul Kohli, but they're also like Carla Gugino has been in a bunch of his work and I have loved her so much forever. She is like an angel of death in this show. Can't really say too much about her character, but she is just like, she is incredible and has a lot of fun. Bruce Greenwood stars as the father of this family. His sister includes Mary McDonnell. Mark Hamill is in the show. It's kind of funny. There are scenes between Bruce Greenwood, who played Commander Pike in the J.J. Abrams Star Trek, Mary McDonnell, who was the president of Earth in Battlestar Galactica, and Luke Skywalker, like, in scenes together. I think that's just really fun. There's a great cast overall. Carl Lumbly's in this, and I love seeing him in everything. Flanagan also uses him well. So if you like Flanagan stuff, if you like good horror, and you just want, like, a cool, fun, you know, spooky October thriller, check out The Fall of the House of Usher on Netflix. That's it for our show this week. Our theme music is by game composer Dale North. Our outro music is by our very own managing editor, Terrence O'Brien. The podcast is produced by producer Ben Elman. You can find me online at Devinder on Twitter, Mastodon, Blue Sky. I'm all over the place. Nate, where can we find you?
These days, I'm mostly using Threads at Nate Ingram over there.
Of course you're on Threads, Nate. Come on. Come on, man. Come to the cool kids. Come to the
nerds. Every time I pop on the podcast, you tell me to check out Mastodon, and I never do it.
Threads. Anyway, email us at podcast@engadget.com. Leave us a review on iTunes and subscribe on anything that gets podcasts. Thanks, folks. We're out.